Well, the first thing I think would be to understand that these kinds of writings are not scientific. They're not scientific any more than sociology is a science. Now, I know people would say that they've gone to college and they've got 2,000 hours in the social sciences and they do sincerely believe that they're a scientist. They're a social scientist, of course. But it's a long stretch. It's a long stretch to get from there to actual, factual, scientific, empirical, verifiable, reproducible scientific evidence. And so, although this document presents itself as a scientific evaluation or of world systems, it doesn't ever produce, it doesn't provide anything that lets you test any of these words. There are no footnotes. There are no references to any scientific studies in it. They don't define their terms. They just use them and pass it along. And for your listeners, and you've had an absolutely fantastic stream, a long stream of guests, Melody, that are so much more educated and knowledgeable than I am, that I'm sure that your audience can understand that there's an agenda going on. And at the global level, at these United Nations meetings, there's thousands of them happening all over the planet. Sometimes that many happen, 4,000 happening in one day, from Joan Bion's research in her book, The United Nations Global Straitjacket. There are hundreds and hundreds of these meetings, if not thousands, going on at all the times. But the people who attend these meetings are not always scientific people. These are people that are like sociologists. These are people who have degrees in political science, perhaps. They're people who have degrees in business or interpersonal communications or any of a variety of these kind of warm and fuzzy or gray issue type of educational avenues of expression, degree fields, if you will. And then they write this sort of stuff, and this then becomes a plan that they will implement. And it's being implemented on us and at us. I'll go into this next section here a little bit. I don't think I answered your question particularly, but maybe more of this will help. The widespread scarcity, gradual destruction, and aggravated pollution of freshwater resources in many world regions. You just take a sentence like that. How would I go back and verify that? The widespread scarcity, gradual destruction, and aggravated pollution of freshwater resources in many world regions, along with the progressive encroachment of incompatible activities, demand integrated water resource planning and management. It's kind of like setting you up mentally to accept their antithesis here, their synthesis. The demand, again, it's always demand this integrated water resource planning and management. And such integration must cover all aspects of interrelated freshwater bodies, including both surface water and groundwater, and duly consider water quantity and quality aspects. And here's a little bit more language. They're building an ideology through the use of language. The multi-sectoral nature of water resources development in the context of socioeconomic development must be recognized, as well as the multi-interest utilization of water resources for water supply and sanitation, agriculture, industry, urban development, hydropower generation, inland fisheries, transportation, recreation, low and flatlands management, and other activities, period. People who would sit down to read something like this, I know the first time that I read this book, let's see if I have it jotted down in the front, I usually put the date when I finished it the first time, Yes, the first time I read the Agenda 21 was in 2005. The second was 2006, twice, 2007, and one time in 2008. So I come back and I read this from time to time. But the first time that I was able to complete it was in 2005. I would say that I had it in my possession for a year, Melody, before I was able to finish this book the first time. And I read lots of books. But there was just something about the writing style that made me distrust it. And it's because of sentences like that. Absolutely too much. Too many words, too little said, if you will. Rational water utilization scheme, just continuing, for the development of surface and underground water supply sources and other potential sources have to be supported by concurrent water conservation and wastage minimization measures. Priority, however, must be accorded to flood prevention and control measures, as well as sedimentation control where required. Transboundary water resources and their uses are of great importance to riparian states. In this connection, cooperation among those states may be desirable in conformity with existing agreements and or other relevant arrangements, taking into account the interests of all riparian states concerned. And then, the following program areas are proposed for the freshwater sixth sector. And they're going to go on now, and they start listing what will make up the rest of these many pages of this chapter. And so, what we kind of come up with in this book, chapter by chapter by chapter, and it covers all aspects of life, what we come up with in here is a call out to the international community to create management and micromanagement and macro management of all of the planet Earth in an extra governmental, extra constitutional fashion, multidisciplinary, multi-jurisdictional. It's a world without borders. It goes back to Aldous Huxley and George Orwell. A management scheme of such a colossal proportion that if it should ever be allowed to come into play, it would have godlike power over all of the inhabitants of the planet Earth. No one would be able to survive inside of this system unless they were allowed to survive inside of this system. And knowing what we know about the population control agenda, we need to address this concept of globalization with a more rational and, I think, abrupt behavior, because right now, with Barack Hussein Obama coming into power and the people that he's arrayed around himself in cabinet format, I can see there that we're going to go into Agenda 21 Sustainable Development with a vengeance. Now, it took a sort of a backseat and got a free ride, although it was continuing to expand during the past 8 years of the Bush administration. But under Hussein, I think this is going to go into overdrive, warp drive, or hyperdrive. They've set very concrete goals. They talk about 2012 and the Vision 2020 plans. And at the local level, all of this is happening. It's happening in Colorado. When I was researching and looking through some various materials before the broadcast tonight, I came across a little sidebar in another document. It's called Protecting Water Resources with Smart Growth. This is put out by the United States Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. And this is in Section 1, Protecting Water Resources at the regional level. And these are practice tips. These are things that locals who are implementing these concepts can utilize locally. These are their solutions, the practice tip. This one is pertinent to you in Colorado. In August of 2000 in Denver, Colorado, five counties and 25 municipalities representing more than 75% of the region's population, adopted the Mile High Compact. Now, this is the second time we've heard tonight about compacts, multi-jurisdictional, multi-regional compacts, the Mile High Compact. The nation's first voluntary city and county-led effort to guide growth. The compact is an intergovernmental agreement through which cities and counties agree to develop comprehensive plans or master plans that support Denver's Metro Vision 2020. And for those of us that have done any study into these things at all, it's enough to make your hair stand straight up. But the Denver's Metro, well, we go back to Chicago there, Metro 1313, University of Chicago, and a visioning plan, visioning statements, and Metro's Vision 2020, and we understand that we're talking about five counties and 25 municipalities representing more than 75% of the region's population. I don't know, Melody, perhaps you can tell me, was this a ballot issue?
I'm not even aware of it.
Funny how these things just slip in.
I know that Fort Brighton is in the middle of trying to adopt a comprehensive plan in our area.
Okay, tell me about that.
Well, I'm not an expert on it. I just know that they've been dealing with this for about 2 years of trying to do a comprehensive plan. And I've just dropped into several meetings just to kind of observe what is going on. And it seems for quite a while they've been divided. I don't know that division has been resolved at this point, but they decided just recently that they're going to move forward with this plan. But what that means, I'm not quite sure yet.
Okay, was this an appointed planning commission, or is this an elected planning commission, or is this just a volunteer board, or how is it comprised?
Well, again, I'm not an expert. I seem to me like they asked the volunteers, and I do know that, you know, there's a number of people that spent quite a bit of time trying to be broken. They were broken up into different groups, and have been working on various aspects of this plan. And we're, again, you know, since I didn't attend all these meetings, I'm not an expert on this. I just know that I recognize the process. And that you might be a little bit more an expert in, you know, what this all means and where it's all going.
Well, my antennas are definitely straight up at this point, because this is the kind of stuff I get these kind of phone calls from all over the United States, people that find this kind of local planning system coming on them and at them right where they are, and they would like to be vocal local and block this globalist agenda before it gets into their towns, because we under...
Yes, I don't see a lot of people recognizing it as that. That's what I'm observing. And a couple of times at the meeting, I'd ask them, you know, are you guys aware of what's going on internationally? And it probably went over Miriam's head. And but the facilitator said, well, I'm following it on a national basis.
Okay, now when you say use the word facilitator, did anyone else in the room use that word in relationship to that person?
I believe so, I'm sure it had to have been said, or I wouldn't have, you know, because that was kind of sort of recognizing the Delphi code.
Yes, well, that person, just to take a pertinent sidebar here, because this in itself is quality for the entire broadcast, but... that particular person, and I don't know that particular person, and I wasn't in the room. But let's just assume that this person is a facilitator, as opposed to just the guy that runs the hardware store, and then perhaps you have a school teacher, and maybe someone from the county commission would be sitting in, or someone like that. this person that would be the facilitator at a planning commission meeting like this, a town planning thing, a comprehensive plan. We're going to develop a comprehensive plan for Salida, for instance. I would guess that the facilitator is a planner with your local regional planning commission, and if not a facilitator from the local regional planning commission, that he or she might also be, or rather be, a facilitator that is coming in from your land grant college or university through the university extension program to help to work with you on that. They might be someone from NEMO, which is an organization that helps to set up these kinds of programs. NEMO is the non-point education for municipal officers or officials, and they go around and they put together these planning groups. But a facilitator's presence there is important, because if the facilitator is there, then you're working most likely in a guided process. The people who are attendees, the people who are the stakeholders, the people who are commenting and participating in the process, are being guided every step of the way, most of the time, by someone that is extremely skilled at this craft, facilitated meeting. And if not, they might be a self-appointed facilitator working with materials that were supplied to him or her, to the group, by the University Extension Council. And you think, oh my goodness, where are you going with all of that? Well, I'm going there from experience. I have their manuals. I have manuals that I've acquired from the University Extension Program at RALA, at Lincoln University, here in Missouri. A facilitator's guide, how you get communities to go along, to get along, how you get people to get into this group idea and get involved with this process of visioning and developing a vision and a mission statement for the county. Usually there's just a couple handfuls, maybe 10, 12, 14 people. Sometimes for every voting precinct in your county, you'll have one representative. But they're not representative of the people. No one said, this is our representative, put this person on the planning commission. They're just people who maybe through their association with the political party, maybe they're a county committee man or a county committee woman in their voting precinct, and because those names always come up, they were just put on this board. But they're the ones then that sit down and they start to craft these comprehensive plans. And water plays a big role in all of this. Water is just one of those things that seems to be used to get this process going. In Agenda 21, in almost all of the chapters, we talk about all natural disasters, hazard mitigation, some kind of a disaster is coming down the pike, and we have to guard ourselves against it. But water resources, particularly at the regional level, are a big deal. Now, if I remember right, Melody, correct me if I'm wrong, you have a river that flows right through Salida, don't you?
Yes.
It's Salida or Salida?
Salida.
Okay. Yeah, if I remember right, I looked at the map before we came on last time, just to kind of get a topographical feel for the space. And you do have a river that flows right through there. From the bank of the river to Main Street, how far would you say it would be? A mile?
Half a mile? 100 yards?
I wouldn't say maybe a quarter mile. I mean, it's only about 2 blocks, actually. You got a quarter mile?
About two blocks, okay. So that could be up to 1,500 feet, maybe something like that, 600 or less, 1,200 maybe with a road 60 feet wide on both sides, somewhere in that vicinity, maybe a quarter of a mile from the river to Main Street. And from the elevation from the bank of the river to Main Street, how much elevation do you gain? Is it 100 feet above, 50 feet above, 10 feet above, or just about flat with the bank of the river?
I'd probably say it's 10 or 15 feet. I'm just guessing.
That's fine. I've been in some places in Colorado where there's a river, but it's down at the bottom of a valley, and the town is like 500 feet above it, and things like that. But let's just say that you're basically at riverbank level. And if that was a plane, and I didn't really get didn't do the Google Earth, didn't really get a topographic map and look at it, but if that was a plane, and that plane was, let's say, half a mile wide, and the river ran through it, a river flows through it, and if we were to think about it from the standpoint of a floodplain, chances are pretty good that the whole town is in that floodplain. If there were 1% chance, or any one day of any year that might flood, if there's any chance of that at all, it would be considered a floodplain. And so all manner of planning contingencies come into play at that point. I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of miles. What's the name of that river that flows through Salida?
It's the Arkansas.
I thought it was. Yep. Okay, so we're going to go from Colorado all the way down to Arkansas. Now let's talk about watersheds just briefly. When we're thinking about protecting water resources...
I got to start here. You're listening to KHUN LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community-supported radio. And this is True Quest with Melody, and my guest this evening is William Roberts. Okay. Did I miss you?
No, you didn't miss me. Is that it?
Yes.
Okay, that was the station ID at the top of the hour, folks. Well done, Melody. Nicely done. Okay, so let's think about the Arkansas River. And think about it from the standpoint of being a drainage basin. If you go all the way up to the top of the mountains on both sides of the river, to the point where it breaks over and starts, the water would break over, the snowmelt would break over and start to flow the other side of those hills, and you run all the way from the headwaters of the Arkansas all the way down to its confluence with the Mississippi, I believe, or it might hit the Missouri. Oh, my, what river does it connect to? I think it goes to the Mississippi, doesn't it?
It is Mississippi.
Okay, it goes all the way to the Mississippi. So from its confluence with the Mississippi all the way to its headwaters, that whole area there is a watershed. Now, if it were possible for me to get all of the people that live in that watershed to move out of that watershed, and if it were possible for me to lock up that whole watershed and protect it as a national treasure, as water, water everywhere, water for everyone quickly, if I were to protect that, and let's say that I would establish some kind of a dollar-denominated value of that much water and let a contract with Suez, the big water group, or Thames, or RWE, if I were to pledge that resource against national debt, I wonder how much money Suez would pay to have all of the water in the Arkansas watershed.
I would venture to say they're not going to pay near what it's worth.
Oh, no. No, this would be a fire sale for sure. But that kind of gives you, a little bit, if we think about in watershed and watershed management, and if we can think of ourselves as being a plague in that watershed, we're the problem. It's the people that are the problem. The people are destroying the planet Earth, according to environmentalists. We're destroying it. We're not here as the stewards. We're here as the destroyers. And so with sustainable development, smart growth, the Green Cross Optimist, the idea is to get the people out of the way, not only out of harm's way, certainly back up out of the floodplain. So your town would have to be relocated to a smart growth community that would be up on the hillside someplace back away from the river. And if you got it back far enough away from the river, then we could add more young women that wouldn't be able to go to school each day because they would have to walk down to the river to get water. But, you know, I'm just being facetious there. But if you could get your entire town to move back away from the water, get back out away from that river, the chances of any flood damage to your town or to your infrastructure would diminish the further and higher away from the river you got. You follow me?
Mm-hmm.
And so what we're doing is we're creating a clear zone, a hazard-free zone along that river. And that's part of what hazard mitigation planning is all about. It's also part of what smart growth and protecting water resources, this particular book that I'm holding here, Protecting Water Resources with Smart Growth, is all about.
And this was written by, again,
the Environmental Protection Agency.
Okay.
EPA. And for the listeners, if you want to get more information, you could get a copy of this booklet. It's a book. You can go to epa.gov. It's just www.epa.gov/smartgrowth. And they have a May 2004 publication. They also have catalogs, a wealth of material that you can obtain. And there's many other references in this book that will link you to more study on this subject than you probably care to do. But part of what's going on here, when we start talking about the Arkansas River watershed, if you were to do an Arkansas River watershed planning comprehensive plan, it would be multi-jurisdictional and multidisciplinary, fitting probably the model of the comprehensive plan that is being developed on the micro scale right now in Salida. But it includes multiple states, many counties, many towns, many cities. It has lots of stakeholders. It has lots of actors in this process. And its scope transforms government so dramatically that to even come up with that kind of a document without writing something like a constitution to go with it or something, to give anybody the management duty or power, to give anybody the ability to write policy for the Arkansas River watershed, and give them the ability to enforce those policies, you've created this enormous new governmental, but it's non-governmental, it's a non-governmental agency, a public-private partnership to be sure, that would control the water and everything that has to do with the water and the resources in that entire basin. And that's a lot of what Agenda 21 is all about.
Okay, now, when you say that, has this been implemented in other parts of the world since this is a global agenda?
Yes.
Okay, and what type of reaction have you, has there been any kind of reaction to this sort of process? Are you aware of this?
Well, for those who've read Perkins' book, The Confessions of an Economic Hitman, when these sorts of things are being promulgated in the developing countries, a different dynamic happens. A different model is being fulfilled there. Throughout the text of Agenda 21, and you know, there's not a page that goes by when you have pages open in front of you like I do that you won't hear this mantra. Here's the mantra: women, youth, indigenous people, and local communities in water management policymaking and decision-making. And I'll read the whole sentence. To design, implement, and evaluate projects and programs that are both economically efficient and socially appropriate within clearly defined strategies based on an approach of full public participation, including that of women, youth, indigenous people, and local communities in water management policymaking and decision-making. These are just, this is like a mantra. It happens, those kinds of words occur over and over and over again. Another one of the mantras here is that the people that live in the developing nations, emerging nations, the backward nations, however you look at it, they have a different criteria. They have a different standard going for them than those of us who live, the Northern Hemisphere people, those of us who live in the developed nations. Was it Ross Perot who said that NAFTA would be like a giant sucking sound as our money went to the southern, went south, went into Mexico and Paraguay and Uruguay and Central America and South America. Our money is going south. The criteria, the burden, the financial burden is placed upon us, we, and they in the southern hemisphere and in other developing areas, they're anticipating us to finance this. But to answer your question, it's different strokes for different folks. It goes back to the three E's of sustainable development, where equity and economy are part of these two of these things. It's a financial concern. We've already identified that through demand. It's an environmental concern. That is always the banner. But there's equity involved in it. Well, equity goes back to the common law courts, the chancery courts. And equity was a way that someone who felt that the burden of law was too heavy or too grievous could make an appeal for relief. And in sustainable development, all of the developing countries can make appeals for relief. So even though these principles and practices are being implemented elsewhere, Melody, they won't be done the same way as they would be done here. Here they will be stringent and stringent to the max, and we will be expected to pay for it. There, it will probably be more along the lines of economic hitmen coming in and working with Hugo Chavez and cutting some kind of a financial deal, and then the corporations will come in and they'll just set up shop. And they'll start pumping and piping and, you know, setting up water treatment facilities and charging everybody and going about it and making great hay. But here in this country, they have to do it at least under the color of law. Does that get there?
I'm getting the impression as I go along researching this sort of thing that there's three or four different stories flying around, and it just depends upon which group that they're talking to. I get the feeling that when the globalists speak to one group, they're talking about this utopia of equality and casting off some of the negative things of our society, and that everything is going to be hunky-dory. Then I get another one where everything's regulated to the max. Are you getting at yourself, or?
Yes, they've mixed signals.
Mm-hmm. one side you get, you know, get everybody agreeing to, and then it's kind of like if you're sitting in front of a group of people that believe communism is the ultimate. Best things, and that's what they say. They speak everything in that direction. You know, if they're a free market capitalistic group, then they're going to tell them what they want. They think they want to hear.
Right.
Okay.
And if you take those two right there, you could almost do a 90-10 model on that, where 90% of the world's population. Are leaning very strongly towards communism, if you will, in even its most maybe we should say socialism in its most extreme and abundant format. And then there's perhaps a 10% of the world's population that when you discuss these sorts of things with them, you need to speak in free market, even though we know that there's no free market. Free trade is managed trade, but you speak to them on the free market level, largely because when you're talking to that 10 percentile group, they're the ones that are going to be part of the international financial community that has to underwrite the other 90%. So when you're addressing a group of what you would consider to be recipients, that's when you want to talk all about utopia. When you are talking to the people who are on the giving end of it, the paying end of it, that's when we need to talk about it as an environmental or a developmental concern, and we need to demonstrate the financial soundness of this kind of a move. There was a period of time 5 years ago when I was involved in researching out what I found to be and understand as logical positivism. It's a branch of the philosophy of positivism, August Comte's system. But in that study, I came out of that study with a sentence that I created that helps me to remember the idea of it. But it's simply this: the obfuscatory linguistics of the logical positivist syntactician. Okay? The obfuscatory linguistics of the logical positivist syntactician. It's syntax. It's a linguistic style. It's logical in that it has to do with the five-sense real world and tries to stay away from emotion. It's the positivism, which is a whole branch of philosophy involved in it. But in a nutshell, words to the logical positivist syntactician are nothing more than symbols. I can say, I could write the words red ball, and to the audience, depending on whom the audience is and in what content it was written, they would perceive it as a red ball. But the red ball does not need to be what I thought. It doesn't need to be what I felt. It doesn't even need to be what I intended to say. I'm using logical positivism from the standpoint that words are symbols. And so if I say sustainable development in one group, it may not have the same meaning to another group. It may not have the same meaning to the group as it had to the speaker or the facilitator when he uses those words. They're just symbols inside of a language game. And then the logical positivist, realizing what they were doing and what they were creating in all of this, they determined that they would come up with meta-languages. In other words, a language about language. And unless you happen to know the meta-language that the logical positivist syntactician is using in his means of communication with his target group, you have no clue about what is being said. When I got this book, Agenda 21, from the United Nations, I ordered it directly from their bookstore. I immediately flipped it open to the back, because I like to start a book in the back and read the index, and there is no index. There's also no glossary of terms. They do have one page where they list all of the acronyms that we can find in this book. Beyond that, you're left at your own devices to try and figure out what is being said. Even the word... Go ahead.
I did run across the site, though, that, and I can't remember the name of it, and it was tied in with Agenda 21, but the whole site was turned.
Exactly. Back in 2004, I was doing a broadcast on Republic Broadcasting, the last two or three months of a program that had been originally run by Chris Gerner. His broadcast was named American Exposé, and due to personal circumstances, Chris wanted to take a holiday from that broadcast, and he asked me to do the show, which I did daily. And in that process, that was when I first got my copy of Agenda 21, And as the process of reading it, I started creating, I realized that I was going to have to create a United Nations Sustainable Development Glossary and Dictionary. Now, I was only on the radio for a couple of months, but it wasn't long after that that those documents started to show up. Some other people went in there and they got real seriously busy. They could see the value in it, and they created a dictionary or a glossary of Agenda 21 terminology. And I haven't gone and seen that, Melody, but if it's out there and if it's extensive, and it should be, it'll be a valuable resource tool for us.
Okay, let's see if I can recall. It wasn't long ago that I ran across it.
Well, so we do need to define our terms as we go through all of this process. But water is an extremely important issue to the fulfillment, if you will, of sustainable development. If I can remember what chapter I was in, I kind of flipped around in my book and closed it. We get back to it now. It's 18, I think, 19.
I also, before we get, I mean, they're tied together, but I also wanted to kind of hit on that part of the water, the recycled part, too. Okay. I don't know if that's jumping too far out of league with where we're at or not.
No, it's not. And, again, because of our involvement here in Southwest Missouri with the Ozark Property Rights Congress, I get questions like along a variety of property rights issues. And I know a woman who is one of our frequent attendees at our meetings, and she called me up and she was having a real problem. She lives not very far away from one of the large chicken processing plants. And she has had nothing but trouble with her well water for a long time. The water now is the point where it actually has stuff in it. I'm talking about wrigglers. I'm talking about things that can be moved. And she is dreadfully afraid of drinking it or bathing in it or using it whatsoever. But her little farm is suffering because her animals get sick if they drink this water. And she lives so close to this processing plant that she's concerned about water contamination from the plant. Well, anytime you get involved with a processing system like that, these plants, I'm not going to name the company, but it's a chicken plant or chicken processor that if you go to the grocery store, you've seen their products, but I won't name the company because I haven't verified any of this stuff. To know that whether what I'm saying here is spot on accurate. It's pretty close, though, guarantee that. But they pump out of the ground in order to process the incredible number of chicken carcasses that they run through on a daily basis. They pump out of the ground millions of gallons of water. And then they have to deal with the water. Now, there are several of those kind of chicken processors around here. One of them that's in the southwest corner of McDonald County, they jettison that water after they've treated it, so to speak. They jettison it right back into a river, and it flows on and it goes into Oklahoma. Now, where this farm is located is up more on the plateau, or more on the top of the plateau, the Ozarks Plateau. And the woman's farm is in elevation. It's below the level of this processing thing. But what they're doing there, not being close to any source of water where they can discharge into water, they're doing a ground leaching process, kind of like pits. And what they do is, what they've done is they plowed up all the land all around this processing plant, and they planted it. And I don't know what particular variety of grasses that they've got out there. And then they set up a very exorbitant and extensive sprinkling system. And after they've treated their water, then they come out, they sprinkle the water onto this grass, and then the grass is cut and mowed and baled for hay, I think. And so what that basically is it's the beginning of a processed water recycling system where they're making, and from an engineering standpoint, they're making an attempt to solve a problem. They know that they're taking a tremendous quantity of water out of the ground in a specific tightly located aquifer from well or wells. Right back on top of those well or wells, they're now discharging the water after it goes through their on-site processed water treatment system, putting it back in. But as our member, or I should say associate, we don't have membership in the Ozark Property Rights Congress. We just all come and represent ourselves. This lady is having a real challenge with her water. Now this is, you could think of it from the standpoint of, imagine you have a small town, and it's not close to a water source like a river, where they can dump water into the river, and they might try a variety of different sewage treatment systems to be able to deal with the stormwater and the sewage water out of their town. And yet they are in the similar situation where they have a well and a couple of water towers that provide water for their community. They're faced with much the same problem. From an engineering standpoint, it's almost a nightmare. Because what are you going to do? As soon as you pour a glass of water on the lawn, if you spill your iced tea on the summer sitting by, you know, on your chair, that water is going to immediately go into the ground. Now, water, as it seeks the center of the earth, the more sand and sediments and silt that it travels through, the cleaner the water becomes. And if it gets down 80 feet, 100 feet, 200 feet, 300 feet, it's getting cleaner with every foot that it goes down. And if it goes down 300 or 400 feet before it gets back to that aquifer, if you've done any kind of treatment at all up above, or if it was just simply tea, it'll be pretty much clean water after it goes through that much sand. But if it has any chemicals in it, if it has any additives and things that, like, let's say alcohol or bleach or fluoride or other things, you'd have to do mathematical models to try and figure out how many feet of sand and of what grade of sand and all of that to get an idea how far that would have to flow down before it would separate off the water, and the water would just keep on heading down and the heavier metal might get trapped somewhere higher. MTBE, the gasoline additives and things like that. If you're in the same town, let's say, and you're working on your tractor and you have a clogged up carburetor and you want to take the carburetor apart and you figure out that your gas tank is full of sediment and all of that, and maybe you've got a few gallons of gasoline in the bottom of the tank of your tractor's gas tank, and so you drain that into a bucket and you take your carburetor apart and you dump that together. Now you've got maybe a gallon and a half or 2 gallons in a bucket, and you kind of look around and see if anybody's watching, and you just kind of walk over along the fence line someplace and dump it. That MTBE and anything else that's in the gasoline itself, is going to immediately start heading for the center of the earth. And that's going to wind up in your aquifer. Same sort of a scenario comes down if you have something like a septic tank in your yard. Time was when someone had a septic tank, the early septic tanks, 55-gallon drum and a pipe. They got more exotic than that back in the 60s and stuff like that. We used to make a concrete box, and then we went to the two-chamber concrete box. Usually made the concrete just for a slab and then come up in concrete blocks and separate it with the center wall, and you have a primary settlement is the first tank, and then the water spills over a small gap at the top and goes down into the second tank and settles again, and then finally goes out in the pipe. Works pretty good. You can call in somebody to come in and suck all the sludge out of it, but it works fairly well. And it did work well, and it worked pretty good until when you go to the grocery store and you buy all these various and sundry chemicals and detergents and cleansers and cleansers and this stuff and that stuff and lime away and squirt away and dippy-doo and slippy-doo and all the rest of that, and you're still putting that down into your septic system, unless it's heavier than water and settles out and gets pumped out and is taken away, it's going to wind up going right down in the ground, right into your well. So these are all real, genuine, and true concerns. What we're going to do about that, you know, that's another story. But one of the problems that is in all of this, and on another broadcast, on a different day, I talk about this. One of the problems that we have to deal with, Melody, is that we've become addicted to the flush toilet. We have a water carriage waste system, whether it's your kitchen sink, whether it's your washer dryer, whether it's taking a shower. You know, everybody around here takes a bath on Saturday, whether we need it or not. The toilet, flushing for nothing more than just a little bit of pee. All of that is a real problem, because what it does is it contaminates the water as it carries the waste to wherever it's going, whether it goes into your septic tank, whether it goes out to a pit in the back of the farm. What do they call that pit? It's a cesspool. Or whether it goes into a sewage pipe and is then carried to a sewage treatment plant in your town, you have the problem of all of that water for that little teeny bit of waste. And so then the first job of a sewage treatment system is to separate the solids and the trash from the water. And then all of the rest of the various processes that happen in a sewage treatment plant are to take that water and get it as clear or clarified as possible and as aerated as possible, and to get it as clean as possible before finally dumping it out again into a waterway. And this has gone on in America ever since John Crapper came up with his toilet, which was really a wonderful invention in New York City, where you've got people living in five-story walk-ups, and the little old lady that lives on the fourth floor somehow or another has to get her honey bucket down to the first floor and back up again clean each day. That toilet was a godsend in their lives, and everyone embraced it, especially after a good drunk. But to do without the toilet, I think, is the beginning of the remedy of a lot of our water problems. Have I hit anything?
Well, ultimately, okay, as far as the how is that going to compare with the chicken processing, or who's going to have the ability to mine, and which takes a tremendous amount of water too, is my understanding. I mean, who's going to have the priorities here when it comes down to this so-called limited resource? And then what has been part of their remedy to make up for this, or make it acceptable that we can be drinking water that didn't quite get filtered because of the mass quantities of things that are going into the water system?
Well, one of the things that we have a real bad habit of, especially in the ignorant and the arrogant America, we have a real trouble with finger pointing. Another thing that we have a trouble with is that we misunderstand or misapply government. We anticipate government to do things that government cannot and should never have been allowed to do. In a free market system, where government is out of the picture, if you will, water treatment would be something that would be bid upon and let out to the bidders, and then we would be able to find out through testing and monitoring whether or not we were getting what we were paying for. If we were paying for a Mercedes and we were getting a Volkswagen, we might be able to make some adjustments in all that. The free market would help considerably. And then again, you've got the enormity, you've got scale involved in it too. And scale has a way of making free markets sometimes appear dreadfully difficult because of the power of the kind of a monopoly and the amount of infrastructure that it would take to build a sewage system and a treatment system for Los Angeles or for San Francisco or for Seattle or for New York City or Boston, any of the others, Kansas City, any large metropolitan area. The power that would be centered in a business if they had the monopoly on all of that, you know, then you have to question, you know, our basis points again. Is it better served by a company that the people own, or is it would be better to let it be a free market thing and let it be run on at profit? Hard to say. How do we get to clean water? How do we get to water that's clean enough that we can drink? There are.
Doesn't this then tie into the Agenda 21?
It does. And these are some of the arguments, you know, the credible aspects of it that you were talking about, where with one audience we talk one way, with another audience we talk another. I'm trying to address both audiences, okay? To try and I don't know why I don't even want to use the word pragmatic, but to try and be as honest as I can on the issue. There is a huge, huge problem. And having worked in the civil engineering business, and we read my bio, but I started out working for a civil engineering company when I was a senior in high school after having spent years in vocational high school and junior high school learning how to be a draftsman. I started out working as an engineer and an office boy, drafter and an office boy in an engineering company, and I stayed with it for some time. I've designed sewer systems and water systems and worked on treatment plant designs and things like that, so I do know a little bit about this particular subject. So there's a place for government to be involved with providing some of these services. But again, we have to, you know, do the checkup from the neck up. The real problem, one of the real problems, not so much the process water. Process water is important when you have this chicken plant and they're going doing their processing, or you have some other manufacturing system, or you've got a mining operation or something like that. These are different. These are all engineering problems that need to be resolved. And in those cases, it should be free market. But we've got a problem, Houston, when we continue to use a system of convenience that was designed for a very dense urban environment, when we use that in a mixed or a widely spread suburban or rural environment. Why would someone living in the country or even in a rural area, even on a place as big as an acre or 2 acres, use a flush tile toilet? They have no legitimate, in my opinion, no legitimate reason to use that style of a toilet. There's no reason to rely upon water. They're not bound by distance. They're not bound by lack of arable soil. There are hundreds of solutions that science could offer to that would solve the problem without the use of water. It's the water that causes most of the problem. You add the water, you add your waste to water, and you add it in a disproportionate ratio. Now, as far as the processed water is concerned, you know, that's a whole other story. On that, they probably, I'm just assuming, but they're probably meeting certain minimum standards for water quality. The question is, is the lobby strong enough to make the minimum standards too low? Are you with me?
Right, and then you get the fact that the people are competing with the water of those of the commercial process. Right?
That's exactly right. When you think about acreage, you've got, let's say, a chicken processing plant in a small town in southwest Missouri. And maybe the plant is sitting on 300 acres, in the middle of 300-acre site, perhaps, something like that. And it's using millions of gallons of water. And so I don't know, I cannot remember, Melody, whether it's millions of gallons per day or per year. I think it could even be per day. it's using tremendous quantities of water. That puts such an enormous burden on that one acreage and on that one aquifer that if that plant got off of that spot and a farm was there, there would be no environmental consequence to even discuss. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes an engineering problem. Now, in a free market system, I want that entrepreneur, I want that business person to be profitable, to be able to sell his products, to be able to transport them to the point of sale, the distribution system, to be able to hire people and do all of those things. But at the same time, I don't want us to go back into, let's say, the period in the early 70s where after World War I and World War II and Korea and all of that, we wound up on the East and in many places around the United States with places that were so toxic, you know, like the Great Lakes after all of the Industrial Revolution got done with them. All of those great monopolists and tycoons, they made killings, if you will, on a super rich, abundant resources of the planet, of our country, and their seemingly unlimited quantity of water. And they made billions and billions, and many of those billions were pure profit, above and beyond the call of what a reasonable profit may be. But then they walked. They took a hike on all of the waste that was left behind, and the government created the Superfund, you know, the Superfund cleanup monies, I think is what they called it. And so we, the people, had to pay for the cleanup of these various places. If you wanted to use Agenda 21 language, there's no equity in that. The polluter needs to clean it up. It should have been dialed into his costs, but there was no oversight. So, are we going to set up a system of global oversight called Agenda 21? Agenda 21 and the Environmental Protection Agency and these various ideas, if they were constitutional, if they had some kind of legitimate governmental credence, not just this fabrication by the specious international community, these documents, all these ideas, if they had grounding in science, if they were based in something other than demand, these are environmental and developmental concerns. Halliburton is in the business of making money. You know, CACI is in the business of making money. Kellogg Brown and Root, they're in the business of making money. RWE, Thames, all these, Suez, they're all in the business of making money. I'm very reticent to turn over control of the planet and our planetary resources to groups that have proven over and over again that they need a watchdog more than my house needs one. There's parts of all of this that are legitimate concerns. We do have to live on this planet. This is the only planet that we have. But does that mean that you and I have to live like cave people? Does that mean that you and I have to live like Bolivian peasants? Does that mean that we have to buy into this green ideology? I don't think so.
You know, Bill, one of the things that I find missing in these documents is the technology. I mean, they seem to want to compensate for abuses, for fines, or costs, but they're not really coming in with the technology to compensate for this. Does that make sense to you?
You're absolutely right. Look at what happens, you know, today, basically, if you were going 5 miles an hour over a speed limit, you would have to pay a fine. If you committed some other one of these victimless crimes, you'd pay a fine. The victims never get the money. the system gets the money. If the EPA fines someone, the victims don't get the money. In other words, the people who've gotten sick or whatever, they don't get any compensation. The system takes the money. It's a really complex thing. We live inside of a management system, administrative system, that is almost incomprehensible. How this nightmarish multi-headed beast has been raised up in here. But you're right when you say that there's no technology to support any of this. What I find in Agenda 21, you read it from cover to cover. What they're talking about in here is that they're going to do studies. They're going to have managers. They're going to increase the capacity of people. We're going to have people who are watching out for blades of grass. We're going to have people who are looking out for the grains of sand. We're going to have somebody who stands and counts the flow of water during the day. There's an endless amount of bureaucracy that is being built here. Government loves bureaucracy. Government loves to be in everybody's face all the time. But these books don't present any solutions.
The other thing that they do is they present a public-private partnership as though it is a private operation, but really it is a convoluted private government entanglement that ends up just feeding itself back and forth from what I'm studying.
Yeah, exactly. If it were, you don't need to have necessarily like a public-private partnership. If you have, well, first of all, we need to get some terms, just generally. But government is public. We can all agree that. We, you and I, we're the private sector. Government is the public sector. So if you have a public-private partnership, it's almost kind of an oxymoron. Well, that's not the right way of saying it. There's a word for it, metaphorical, maybe something like that. We, the people, are the government. And so we're the private. So the best we could hope for would be a private-private partnership. A public-private partnership is a different animal. I think Michael Shaw says it pretty well. He says that it's the force of government combined with the wealth of private industry. Unfortunately, you know and I know that through the influence of the NGOs, through the influence of the foundations, through the influence of the corporations, through the influence of the lobbyists, and so on and so forth, they're buying the best government that they can afford. We, the people, aren't represented in this public-private partnership interest. The big money monopolies, the monopolists, the Rockefellers and all of them, are saying to government, the people that they've helped to put into place and through the two-party political system, they're saying, this do. And then government does. And we, the people, are left holding the bag. And as we've seen over the last couple of months, I mean, they're stacking up to the trillions now in this funny money debt. These books talk about, Agenda 21 discusses, the cost of setting up all of this bureaucracy. But they don't talk about the expense. How much is it going to cost? Where's the money? Where's the wealth going to come from that it's going to take to create this utopian 21st century program here? And again, they don't even provide the technological offering to accomplish these things. These are just things we'll study. And then they make... Go ahead.
We hear about all this technology, but we're having a hard time paying for the basics. How are we going to afford this technology? And where is the incentive for these corporations to put money into this technology if they can make all kinds of money off of the basics?
Well, what incentive would there be? And good question. What incentive would there be to come up with a better way of dealing with household human waste, if you could put it that way? What incentive would there be if you could make more money off of a water carriage sewage system? What advantage would there be if you could make more money off of carrying away sacks of garbage on the street? There's a real...
There could be all kinds of money made, but the sad part about it is that corporations have a tendency to only take the top money makers and cut out any of these other aspects that may be up and coming or in competition or in some form or fashion not supporting their model. Does that make sense to you at all?
Sure. You take the automobile, take the carburetor, take the miles per gallon of gasoline. In the United States, GM and Ford are selling automobiles here. They get 25 and 30 miles a gallon. I've never been to Europe, so I can't testify to this, but what I have heard is that in Europe, Ford and GM are selling automobiles over there that get 70, 80, 90 miles a gallon. So it's a system by, again, this monopolist control. To what advantage? How do I profit? Cubono. How do I profit by giving we the people, by giving you the people, an automobile that gets 150, 250, or never uses a gallon of gas if I also sell gasoline? How can I... go ahead.
If you take it back to the Hegelian dialectic and take it back to water, I mean, when they found out that they could make tons of money by selling bottled water, where's the incentive to clean up the water so that people don't buy bottled water?
Well, bottled water is part of the dialectic, I think. When you go into that, when you go down that aisle in the grocery, when I was growing up, that aisle didn't exist, but now it exists. It's the water aisle, I call it, and I never go down it. But when you go down that aisle, what they're basically doing with all of this bottled water and this thing and spring water and filtered and this and that and the other and certified pure and certified fresh and fresh and sweetened and sweetened and hot and tangy and cool and sparkly and bubbly, fizzy, fuzzy and all the rest of the water in that aisle, what they're trying to tell you is that you can't drink the water out of your tap.
Right.
And so they're it's like a fear-based motivation. They're making you believe that something that is provided in super abundance by our Creator is now a scarcity and something that you should pay for. You know, the next step is charging for every breath you take. So it's a process by which we're turning something that is absolutely super abundant. I mean, what is it? The planet Earth. You know, it's two-thirds or three-quarters the surface of the Earth is water. There's no shortage of water here. There's a process where every single day, you know, today I got rained on here in my yard. When I lived on my little farm for 14 years, I had rain barrels out just along one side of my shop building. I lived there 14 years using rain barrels to collect off of just a 12 by 24 galvanized steel roof. I was never out of water. I didn't have a lot of water. I was never out of water. I move over into this little town, and off and on throughout the whole summer, it's been a rolling brownout for a water supply. Some days the water's on, some days the water's low pressure, some days the water's off. Never tastes very good, doesn't ever look very clean. It's kind of a process, a conditioning process, getting us into this idea that water is this exceedingly expensive thing. Right now, you go down that water aisle, and people are paying as much for water as they pay for fuel. Gasoline. How much is it for how much would it be for a gallon of soda water?
Well, it just depends. It just doesn't make... I mean, the logic is missing here in this whole process, and what Agenda 21 seems to be being the answer for. Where's the incentive for these public-private partnerships to really do what this agenda is being presented to the public as?
I don't think there is an incentive for them to perform on this specious contract. What is in here, where the money is at in here, is government services. If you can employ, it's like back when Bill Clinton and Al Gore were in office, I was at a NEPA process meeting trying to challenge the United States Forest Service on the implementation of permitting the Alpine Lakes Wilderness Area. They wanted to charge you, you know, it was like the Pink Paradise song. They wanted to put up a parking lot and charge everybody dollars to go into the wilderness. You had to get a ticket to get in there. While I was challenging them, one of the conversations that came up was that under the Clinton-Gore administration, they wanted to make government the employer of choice. They wanted to be able to attract and retain the very best minds. They wanted to have the best wages. They wanted to have the best benefits packages and make it an attractive thing so that they could get the best and brightest minds. Well, they've succeeded. They've done that. And they want to do that all over the whole planet. They want the best and brightest minds all working in government, doing these meaningless paper shuffling jobs, producing documents like the Agenda 21 and this Protecting Water Resources with Smart Growth, and then managing and micromanaging and managing our land. They want to have code enforcement officers who can come out and arbitrarily and capriciously charge and levy fines against you and take your property without eminent domain or due process and all of these other things. This is the goal. It's like we're building this panopticon system around us where instead of actually being producers, we're just unleashing this horde of these super social scientists who will plague us to death with endless, trivial, meaningless Dadaism.
That's kind of what it looks like to me, but...
Well...
And apparently, in the meantime, they're creating this group of commercial aspects. I mean, like several of the people that have designed the documents or behind these documents being put out are putting themselves at the top of the corporations that are going to stand to make the most money off of this process.
And look at the money that they are making. You know, we're starting to hear some truth out of these various media people when they talk about some of these corporate heads getting, $100 million bonuses and $50 million bonuses and $25 million bonuses and things like that. Ungodly, unholy, thankful, unreasonable amounts of money being skimmed off the top of these various systems. And it's another form of hidden tax, but it's definitely building a system that is bound to just enslave the people. So I always look back at the local level. What can we do? We've got all of this insanity coming on us and at us. And I believe that if we become very, very active right where we are, if we do attend those planning commission meetings, if we do read these books, if we do go in and ask questions and ask questions and ask questions and don't stop asking questions until we really do get answers, if we can ask enough questions, maybe the super social scientists, the nanny state people, maybe they'll start questioning what it is that they're doing. In the process of answering our questions, they might find that what they're doing is meaningless Dadaism. If we can stop it at the local level, before it comes in and infects our towns, if we can save one county and another county and another, we could start building systems of freedom and start regaining the common sense that our ancestors had, that my parents had, that I still believe that I have. That if we can just get this going on a local level, here, there, in Salida and in Barry County and McDonald County and all the different counties, if we can get this started, Melody, I think we can start turning this, because as more people come to read these documents, as more people go into this particular discussion that we're having, we can see that we're being given false information, false promises. And I think it's almost, if it's not criminal, it borders on criminality.
Right. While you're at it, why don't you talk about, you know, what radio program that you have, and ahead.
Okay, I surely will. For any of the listeners out there tonight that would like to keep in touch with me on a daily basis, I do have a radio broadcast that I do Monday through Friday from noon until 1 o'clock Central Time. You can go on the internet to www.rtrradio.com. That's rtrradio.com. Or in your browser, you can just type in Restore the Republic Radio. And again, my name is William Roberts. I do a broadcast called Become Vocal Local, and it focuses on local solutions to global problems.
And do you want to get out your email address or anything?
Absolutely. Anyone that has a question about anything I've said tonight, you need to have some documentation or want to get in touch with me, maybe you have questions what's happening in your area, you can always reach me at host@vocallocal.org. That's host@vocallocal.org, which is also the name of my little website, vocallocal.org.
And well, I want to thank you for coming on tonight, and you know, we finally got our technical problems worked out there. I think that, you know, I mean, I find when I listen to your program, you've got always putting out a wealth of information I'm not hearing from other areas. And you like to try to get your facts right when you're doing it. So, I want to thank you, and we hope to have you back again.
Well, I'd love to, Melody. I thank you for inviting me along, and it's always fun with live radio because you never know how it's going to go, but it's always going to be live. And so we just have to do the best we can with every broadcast, and I've sure enjoyed being here tonight.
Okay, well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Good night.
Good night.